Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores. We are very excited tonight to have Robin Oliveira here with her well-received debut novel, My Name is Mary Sutter. Once you begin this intriguing story, you'll find it very hard to put down. Robin Oliveira received an MFA in writing from Vermont College and was awarded the 2007 James Jones First Novel Fellowship for her work in progress. Other notes of interest, she holds a BA in Russian and studied at the Pushkin Institute in Moscow. Robin is also a registered nurse in critical care, which you will witness the evidence of while reading My Name is Mary Sutter. Please help me welcome Robin Oliveira.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. It's just so delightful, especially as a debut author, to come to a city where I know no one, and then here are all these lovely faces. So thank you so much. My sister, however, is in the corner over there. She looks just like me. Where to begin telling you about My Name is Mary Sutter? I spent so many years raveling the multiple story strands together to make a whole that now teasing it apart has been a new challenge for me. But My Name is Mary Sutter is many things. It is a family saga. It is a love story. It is, in fact, multiple love stories with multiple love triangles. It is about the beginning of modern nursing in America, about the beginning of modern medicine. It's about the unpreparedness on both sides of the Civil War for what was the medical and political apocalypse that was to come. But mostly, it's about Mary Sutter, a young 20-year-old, preternaturally gifted midwife from Albany, New York. And that's where I'm from. That's why she's from there. Who comes from a long line of French midwives. Her mother is Amelia Sutter. Amelia taught Mary everything she knows. Mary has a twin sister, a fraternal twin sister, who is more beautiful than she is and has no interest at all in midwifery. Mary also has a younger beloved brother named Christian, who she adores and he adores her in turn. She had a father named Nathaniel who actually died, and it was in watching his death that she decided she wanted to become a physician. But it is that choice and then a series of difficult choices after that that lead her to consequences that she can't possibly imagine and that utterly changes her life and changes the life of her family forever. This book first came to me as an auditory image. I live on Cougar Mountain outside of Seattle, which still has cougars and bobcats and bear. We have a big, huge, gorgeous Coosa dogwood in our backyard. And in Indian summer, which is basically the only time we get summer in Seattle, a thrush comes and sings to us every evening in our backyard, year after year after year. And it has this, if you've ever heard a mountain thrush, it has this beautiful song. It starts very low and it goes very high. It's a very long song. It's operatic in the way it sounds, and it always evokes in me this great sense of yearning. And I always think that the bird is lamenting the loss of the summer as well. But one particular night, I said to my husband, I think this is the last beautiful day for a long time. And about 2 seconds later, I said, I think there's a novel in that somewhere. About 2 days later, I had a vision of a young woman seated in period dress, seated at a trestle table. She was wearing period dress. She was looking into a brass microscope. There was a candle burning at her side, and around her were bookshelves, much like this, filled with old textbooks. I could tell that she was pursuing something scientific. I could tell that she had to do it alone. I could tell she was doing it at night and that she did something else with the rest of her time. But that was all I knew. So I started to do a little research into women in science. And what I discovered from that research was that 16 or 17 women became physicians out of their experiences in the Civil War. So now I knew that my character, who I would later name Mary Sutter, wanted to be a doctor, and I also knew the time period. I knew it was the Civil War. So for about 6 months, I started to write a draft, but I had huge questions. I didn't really know that much about the Civil War when I started. I didn't know how many women were doctors then. I didn't know how you would become a physician then. I didn't know how society would treat a woman like that. I didn't know how men would treat a woman like that. And so with all these questions and needing to know more about Civil War medicine, I got on a plane and went to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. from Seattle. And they have this fabulous research room, and you can go there and register as a researcher and ask for anything you want, and they will bring it to you. It's like a little miracle. I just can't believe they let anybody come in off the street and do that. And I'm a total nerd. I like libraries much more than I like pubs, so this was a great deal of happiness for me. And so what I asked for was any ephemera or any primary documentation from the Civil War hospitals in Washington City, as Washington, D.C. was then called. And they brought me a library cart of not that much, because not that much primary documentation has survived from the Civil War. I had sort of cardboard boxes on the table in front of me. I had ledgers about like this, I'm going to say 10 by 13, leather bound. And then there were these smaller notebooks, just like this, maybe 6 by 7. They were covered in marbled paper. They were like any empty book that you might buy at a bookstore. I started with the boxes, and in the boxes were things like doctors' contracts and things like that, which were not that much help to me, although I did get a character's name out of that perusal. The ledgers and the marble books were actually encased in plastic, so I had to open them up, and we wear white gloves there to make sure that you don't further destroy the books. And I could tell that the ledgers were actually probably from the 1870s, and the Civil War was 1861 to 1865, because it was all in the same handwriting, and they used to hire copyists to archive material, so they had clerk after clerk after clerk taking primary documentation and putting it together in some order. These were the ledgers of the sick and wounded, the admissions guides to all the hospitals, many of the hospitals in Washington, D.C. I set those aside, and then I opened the marble notebooks. The covers, as soon as I touched them, started to fall apart. The edges of the paper were crisp and brown, and the pages were yellow. And when I opened those bindings, they cracked. And I suddenly knew that I might be the first person in maybe 100 years to look at these little notebooks, that they had been hiding away in the archives, I'm hoping waiting for me. I learned very quickly by looking at what was written inside was that these were probably notebooks that nurses went out and bought to try to find some way to organize the chaos that was quickly becoming the burgeoning hospital system in Washington, D.C. And when I first opened it up, it was things like how many eggs to buy from the egg man and what to pay him, then how much milk to buy and how often. But then as the pages turned, and I'm thinking as time passed, there were hastily scrawled lists of women who had come into the hospitals to nurse after a particular battle. Then after that, there were sort of rapid bed counts of who was in what bed and how many beds they had left in the hospital. Then there were copies of letters to dead soldiers' families. And I was beginning to understand at that moment what it meant to be a nurse in the Civil War, especially at the beginning. I zeroed in on the Union Hotel Hospital which was in Georgetown. And Georgetown was then a separate city from Washington. There was about a mile of rural area in between. Now, of course, they're connected. The Union Hotel Hospital was a completely dilapidated place. It was an old hotel. George Washington used to stop at the tavern and have a beer on his way out of town on the toll road there, which will tell you how old it was, at least 90 years old. And like many of the public buildings in Washington, it had been commandeered by the federal government to take care of all the sick that were pouring into the hospitals. So now I knew where she would end up. I knew that she would end up in the Union Hotel. I went from there to the Library of Congress, and I read Dorothea Dix's personal letters. You remember Dorothea Dix as the prison reformer and the reformer for the mentally ill? She wanted to start a nursing force because she had met Florence Nightingale in the Crimea after the Crimea. She'd gone to England personally to meet her, and she came back, and she actually asked for a meeting with Lincoln. And Lincoln appointed her the first female superintendent of Army nurses. Dorothea Dix was basically, at that moment, inventing nursing in America. Then I read the U.S. Sanitary Commission original documents. The U.S. Sanitary Commission was formed by women back home who were terrified for their husbands and their sons, because at the beginning of the war, it was basically a public health nightmare. Lincoln asked for 75,000 men to come immediately after Fort Sumter was fired on to defend Washington City, because Virginia, of course, to the south had already seceded. Maryland to the north was very ambivalent. He would eventually suspend habeas corpus and imprison half the legislature of Maryland to keep it from seceding. So he was very worried, and 75,000 men came and built forts around Washington in the first 3 months of the war. And mostly they were country boys, and they had never seen measles or mumps because they had never been exposed to the pathogens. They all fell ill, and they ended up filling the patent office, the Treasury Building, the Union Hotel Hospital, Lydia's seminary around town. So there were all these hospitals filled with wounded, and the U.S. Sanitary Commission went around and basically took stock of what was going on. They made up a form, and they went around and asked questions. I was able to find the actual original form for the Union Hotel Hospital and for Fort Albany, where my characters end up, because they're from Albany, and they go and build a fort. So with that, armed with that, I went to the National Museum of Health and Medicine at Walter Reed, which has an enormous permanent Civil War exhibit, and I was able to see the amputation kits. They still have severed legs. In alcohol, they have the bullet that killed Lincoln. It's quite extraordinary. You can see it all there. And I did the same at the Civil War Museum in Frederick, Maryland. At about that time, early on in the writing of the book, I thought that the book might end at the Battle of Gettysburg. So I went there next. And I don't know if you've ever been at a Civil War battlefield before. I had never been. It is the most extraordinary experience. It feels like there are ghosts there. I hired a guide. You can hire a guide. He will take over your car and drive you all around. So I saw Little Round Top and Big Round Top. And then he took me to the stone wall that sits on a high ridge overlooking a slope and then a long field. And in the distance, there are trees. That was the point, the northernmost push that the rebels made during the entire war, and the Federals held the line there at that stone wall. That was where Lieutenant Pickett of the Confederates sent his 5,000 men for Pickett's charge, and they were all slaughtered by the Federals, who had the better position above. It was a cold day when I was standing there, and it felt sacred to me. I was beginning to understand some of the importance of the war for the people who lived it then and how much we've forgotten. I went then to the cemetery at Gettysburg. Now, Lincoln's Gettysburg address was to consecrate the cemetery there. There are 278 words in the Gettysburg Address. It's probably the most famous speech ever given, and you'll remember it from middle school or junior high school. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the prospect that all men are created equal. I won't read you the rest, but I count words as a writer to see what it is that the writer is emphasizing. And in that brief 278-word speech, he used the word dedication and devotion over and over again. Standing in that cemetery, reading that the plaque where the address was, now I knew what it was all about. No matter what side you were on, no matter what you were doing, it was all about dedication and devotion. So with those images whirling around in my head, I went back to Georgetown. And I stood there on the sidewalk. And if you've ever been to Georgetown, you know it's very busy, it's very trendy, boutiques, restaurants, fabulous place. Everybody loves to go there. And I found the location of the hotel. It had been razed years ago. And I was standing there and I thought, nobody remembers. Nobody remembers what sacrifices the doctors, the nurses, and the soldiers made, and what they faced without the benefit of antibiotics, IVs, modern surgery, anything. They had chloroform and they had morphine, but not much of that. So then I really felt as if my character, who I'd first seen while I was standing in my dining room after listening to a thrush sing, I felt like she was whispering in my ear and saying, please, please, remind everybody what we did. So that was it. I was going to write the book. There was no going back. That was it for me. There's one more thing I want to tell you about medicine before I read a few pages from the book. During the Civil War, doctors, for their education, had a six-month run of courses. That was it. They went to school for 6 months. They rarely touched a patient. They observed from afar. And they did not have to prove clinical competence when they graduated. There was not a single nursing school in the United States. Nursing as a profession as we know it now did not exist. You could hire a nurse from city directories. If you go back and look at the city directories from the 1860s, you'll see nurses listed. But those were women you would hire to come sit by your ailing aunt and make certain that she ate and, you know, was bathed. The other thing was that there was no germ theory yet. A Hungarian physician named Semmelweis in Europe round about in the 1850s began to postulate that there might be something like microbes. He didn't use that word, but he was beginning to sense that it was being passed hand to hand. But he had tertiary syphilis, which can make you insane. And no one believed him, and they lured him to an insane asylum where they doused him with cold water for 2 weeks and he died. It would not be until 1867, 2 years after the end of the Civil War, that Joseph Lister published in Lancet the idea that we should wash our hands between patients. Surgery in the United States, if it was done at all, was done as a last resort because, of course, everybody was dying and they didn't know why. There's a statistic that in 1 year in Boston, only 54 surgeries were attempted and almost everybody died. The other major thing that made the Civil War the medical apocalypse that it was is that in Vincennes, France, at the end of the 50s, a man named Meunier developed the mini ball, as we now know it here, the Meunier ball. It was not actually a ball. Musket balls were actually round. This was actually the conical bullet that we know now that's shot through a rifle. It was twice as fast, twice as deadly, and twice as accurate as the musket ball. The musket ball, when they shot it, didn't have a very good range, and it tended to kind of do this. And so if it entered flesh, it would just pierce the flesh, but it wouldn't shatter the bone. The mini ball shattered bones in a way no one had ever seen before. So that was the medical world into which my characters were thrust. And I'm going to read from chapter one, just a few pages, from My Name is Mary Sutter. And then we can have some questions. Chapter 1. Are you Mary Sutter? Hours had passed since James Blevins had called for the midwife. All manner of shouts and tumult drifted in from the street, and so he had answered the door to his surgery rooms with some caution. But the young woman before him made an arresting sight, taller and wider than was generally considered handsome, with an unflattering hat pinned to an unruly length of curls, though an enticing brightness about the eyes compensated. "Mary Sutter, the midwife?" he asked. "Yes, I am Mary Sutter." The young woman looked from the address she had inscribed that afternoon in her small leather-bound notebook to the harried man in front of her, wondering how he could possibly know who she was. He was all angles, and his sharp chin gave the impression of discipline, though his uncombed hair and unbuttoned vest were damp with sweat. "Oh, thank God," he said, and clutching her by the elbow, pulled her inside and slammed the door shut on the cold April rain and the stray warble of a bugle in the distance. James Blevins knew Mary Sutter only by reputation. "She is good, even better than her mother," people said. Now he formed an indelible impression of attractiveness, though there was nothing attractive about her. Her features were far too coarse, her hair far too wild, and already beginning to silver. People said she was young, but you could not tell that by looking at her. She was an odd one, this Mary Sutter. A kerosene lantern flickered in the late afternoon dimness, revealing shelves of medical instruments, scales, tensile prongs, hinged forceps, manorial and chest stethoscopes, jars of pickled fetal pigs, ether stoppered in azure glass, a femur bone stripped in acid, a human skull, a stomach floating in brine, jars of medicines, an apothecary's mortar and pestle. Mary could barely tear her eyes from the bounty. "She is here at last," the man said over his shoulder. Mary Sutter peered into the darkness and saw a young woman lying on an exam table, a blanket thrown across her swollen belly, betraying the unmistakable exhaustion of late labor. "Excuse me, but were you expecting me?" Mary asked. "Yes, yes," the doctor said, waving her question away with irritation. "Didn't my boy send you here?" "No, I came to see you on my own. Are you Dr. Blevins?" "Of course I am." Now that the time had come, Mary felt almost shy, the humiliation of her afternoon rearing up, along with the anger that had propelled her here, looking for a last chance. On her way, she had waded through crowds, barely conscious of a mounting commotion, lifting her skirts out of the mud, struggling past the tannery and the livery, finally arriving at the two-story frame building with its unpainted door and narrow steep stairs, so unlike the echoing marble hallways where she had just been refused entry. And all the while, newspaper boys had been yelling "Extra!" and tributaries of people had been trickling toward the Capitol, and still she had pressed on. "Dr. Blevins, I came here today." Mary stopped and exhaled. All the hope of the past year spilled over as she stumbled over her words. "Today I sat in the lobby of the medical college for 4 hours waiting for Dr. Marsh, and he didn't even have the courtesy to see me." Mary shut out the memory of her afternoon in the unwelcoming misery of the Albany Medical College, where after several hours the corpulent clerk had finally hissed, "Dr. Marsh no longer wishes to receive letters of application from you, so you are to respectfully desist in any further petition." "When he refused to see me, I decided to come and ask something of you," Mary said. "Would you mind asking me later?" Blevins asked, propelling Mary toward the young woman. "I need your help. This is Bonnie Miles. Her husband dropped her here early this afternoon. He said she has lost a child before, her first. I think the baby's head is stuck." Mary pulled off her gloves and unwrapped her shawl, her quest forgotten for the moment, all her attention focused on the woman's exhaustion and youth. Bonnie was small-boned, tiny in all her features, too young, Mary thought, perhaps 15, maybe 17. Her hips were too narrow, which might be the problem Dr. Blevins had encountered. "Have you been laboring long?" Mary asked. The doctor answered for her, speaking quickly and nervously. "She cannot say, since the night at least." Mary lifted her gaze from the girl to appraise the doctor with a cool, steady glance. "No chloroform? No forceps? Why do you think I called you? I've seen enough of the damage those can do. I'm a surgeon, for God's sake, not a butcher. Please," the doctor said, "I need your help." Of late, surgeons had entered the obstetrics trade, but there had been too many mistakes to make him feel comfortable. He didn't like administering chloroform to ease the mother's pain, because babies ended up languishing in the womb, and doctors had to go hunting for them with forceps. Too many women had bled. Too many baby skulls had been crushed. He would stick with the ailments of men, hatchet blows and factory burns. "You'll help me?" the girl asked. As Mary smoothed the blanket, she thought that the girl resembled Jenny, though she lacked Jenny's distinguishing clarity of skin. But the wide-set eyes, the high cheekbones, and the bright lips had emerged from the same well of beauty as Mary's twin. Once, when Mary was very young, she had asked her mother what twin meant, and her mother, who had understood the root of the question, had answered, "God does not give out his gifts equally, even to those who have shared a womb." "My last one died," Bonnie said, whispering, drawing Mary close to her, her face transforming from a feverish daze to one of grief. "I beg your pardon?" "The baby before this," Bonnie said, her eyes half closed. "I didn't know it was labor I was taken with, you see?" The ignorance. It was exactly like Jenny. But Jenny's ignorance was something altogether different, a refusal to engage, to exert herself, a lack of curiosity. Outside, above the street clatter of carriages and vendors, came the hard clang of the fire bell and cries of, "On to the south!" Blevins rushed to the window and threw it open as Mary whispered to Bonnie not to worry. The rising strains of a band joined the bugle, producing a festive off-tune march that beckoned like a piper. A swelling crowd hurried along the turnpike, shoulders and wool hats bent against the rain. In the distance, the flat pop of gunfire sounded. "You there, hello, can you give me the news?" Blevins cried. A man who had stopped to don an oilskin looked up, revealing a slick, battered face, pocked, the doctor was certain, at the ironworks where the spitting metal often scarred workers' faces. "Haven't you heard?" the man shouted. "The Carolinians fired on Fort Sumter." "Has Lincoln called for men?" the doctor asked. But the scarred man melted into the stream of revelers, pushing down the muddy turnpike toward the music as if something were reeling them in. James Blevins slammed down the window and turned. "I cannot believe it," he said. "It is war." And I'll stop reading there.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.